God's relentless pursuit of Ruth and you and me. Have you ever heard of the paraphrase of the Bible called The Message? You ever read any of that? Okay. That was done by a man by the name of Eugene Peterson. He was the pastor of a church in Bel Air, Maryland for about 30 years and then moved to the northwest of the United States and died there actually last fall. And at his funeral, one of his sons by the name of Eric spoke part of the eulogy. And in that eulogy, he said, with all that my father accomplished, all the books, the translation, 30-year pastor in one place, he said he had really had everybody fooled because he only had one message. He said he spoke that message into our hearts as a family and into my heart, Eric said, for 50 years. He said he used to come into my room at night when he thought I was asleep and whisper it into my ear. He said, and this is the message. God loves you. He is on your side. He's coming after you. And he is relentless. You'll hear more about my story. But God has relentlessly come after me. And through that process, my youngest daughter, our youngest daughter, but she's really mine, but she has taken to that point about the relentlessness of God. And she reminds me of it all the time as we talk. And she even told me when I was in the hospital room in ICU, she said, Dad, when you get better, you and I are going to get a tattoo together. And it's going to say, he is relentless. I said, okay. Well, I got better. So, just well know, at some point in the future, I'm going to get a tattoo. Never imagined. I've been shot with a lot of needles in my life, but I never imagined it'd be one with ink in it. He is relentless. And he relentlessly pursues his people. He relentlessly pursues you, even when you don't realize it. Even whenever we are wondering, God, where are you? What are you doing? Don't you see what's going on? And so I got to ask you a question this morning. And it's a question you need to ask yourself. What is God doing in your life? Right now, what is God doing in your life? Now, in fairness, sometimes it's not easy to see what God's doing in our life until we look in our rearview mirror. And then we see where God has been and where his footsteps are, and we realize that as the familiar poem that whenever there was only one set of footprints in the sand, that's when he was carrying us. But sometimes it's hard. It's hard to know that's going on, and that's the story of Ruth. And so I want us to look at that story this morning. Let's face it, stuff happens. Stuff happens to everyone. There is some good stuff. There's some bad stuff. It's where God is at in all of this stuff, we're wondering. And even Jesus himself said, my God, why have you forsaken me? So when you wonder, where's God? Even Jesus wondered that in that moment of weakness. And I think the point is that God was there. It was all part of his plan for his life, and he has a plan for your life. 1,100 years ago, it was the time of the judges. Israel was in that familiar cycle. Whenever they did good, God blessed them. Whenever they did evil, God disciplined them, and they were overtaken by some other nation or sent off into captivity. They just went in this cycle. I thought, you know, if God were Italian, he's not, but if he were Italian, he would look at these people, Israel, and he'd say, you know, what gives? Because don't you know what's going to happen? But don't you know that when he looks at you, and if he were Italian, he would look at you and I and he'd say, don't you know? Don't you know what's happening? Don't you realize that I'm still involved here? And so the last line in the book of Judges kind of describes what was going on there. It says, in those days, Israel had no king. And I think that's an interesting statement. They had a king. His name was God. His name was Yahweh. But in their eyes, in those days, Israel had no king. All the people did whatever seemed right to them in their own eyes. And so in Ruth chapter 1, we pick up right after that. And it says, in the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and his two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech. And if you want to remember how to say that, just think of the movie, In the Jungle, the Mighty Jungle, the Lion Sleeps Tonight. Remember? A weema whip, a weema whip, a weema whip, a weema whip. Well, it's Elimelech. And you'll never hear that song again and not think about Elimelech. Okay? In those days, it says, this man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their sons, Mahlon and Chilion, they were Ephrathites. They were from Ephraim, from Bethlehem, in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. Now, it's a short story. It really is. I mean, that part of their sojourn. Elimelech, which, by the way, his name means, my God is my king. Good name. He didn't remember that because he left Bethlehem. And he takes his wife, Naomi, whose name means pleasant, and his two sons, and they must have been having a bad day when they named their sons, because one of them's name is Mahlon, and his name means wimpy or sick, and Chilion, his name means perishing or dying. It's like today, you have a child and say, this is my child, typhoid, and this is bubonic plague. Just want you to know about him, you know? To have two kids sick, and I got to believe that God is doing something in the text here to make a point, because as we read on through the story, that not only is their name, that is their destiny. Okay, that's their identity. And so they leave Bethlehem, which means, by the way, house of bread, or the breadbasket. Now think about all the ironies here. Elimelech, whose name means my God is my king, decides to do like the rest of Israel and become his own king in his own eyes, and leave the breadbasket, even though it was during a rough time, a famine, and go to Moab, which is their arch enemies. They've been fighting them since they crossed the Red Sea. A place that worshipped an idol that included human sacrifice. That's where they went to live. And it doesn't say they just lived there. It says they settled there. And they were there for over a decade. Naomi's men, though, are short-lived. Chapter 1, verse 3 through 5. Then Elimelech died. And Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, not Oprah, but Orpah. The other, a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, sick and dying and wimpy, they died. And they were wimpy because neither one of them had a child. Neither one of them left a person to carry on the heritage and the lineage of their family. And so here we have Naomi alone, without her two sons, and without her husband. I've not lost a spouse, thank God. My wife thought she was going to lose me. In fact, in June of 2018, I was in a semi-comatose state for 4 days. I did not know who or anything that was going on, and she called in the family. And she told me, she said, I didn't think you were going to make it. But not only that, she lost two children. Our children are supposed to bury us. We're not supposed to bury our children. If anyone has a right to be bitter, angry, despondent, she did. So at this point in the story, Naomi decides to exit, if you will. And this becomes not just a man's story. In fact, it becomes a woman's story from this point on, until another man comes into the picture. And so here we are with Naomi. She has no family, no men, no home. She's all alone in a foreign land. All she has is her two ex-daughter-in-laws, the widows of her sons, Orpah and Ruth. And she decides to go back to Judah because she heard that they were being blessed by good crops. And so they head back to Judah. She and her daughter-in-laws are on their way, and on the way, Naomi thinks, these are Moabite women. They have no business going back to Israel. I mean, who's going to accept a Moabite woman in Israel? And so she tries to talk them into staying, and finally, Orpah agrees, and they kiss and hug, and Orpah goes back, which, by the way, I don't think it's fair, but it's true that Orpah means deserter, which is, again, kind of ironic. But Ruth, she is unalterably committed to stay with Naomi. And so we come to Ruth chapter 1, verse 16. And this is the famous passage that is often read in wedding ceremonies. Ruth replied, "Don't ask me to leave you or turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us." When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said nothing more. And so it took about 2 weeks by foot in that time over that land to make the trip. So it was good that Naomi had somebody to go with her, because it was a rough trip for anybody, but two women by themselves would have been difficult. But they finally make it to Judah, and it's a bittersweet homecoming. In Ruth chapter 1, verse 19 through 22, it says, "So the two of them continued their journey, and when they came to Bethlehem, the entire town was excited by their arrival." "Is it really Naomi?" the women asked. Man, you can hear it. If you've ever seen Jewish women, I've had the privilege of being in Israel. And, you know, you go to the market, and it's not just the women. It's the men and whatever. They are animated, okay? They don't just talk to one another. You know, I mean, the hands are going and they're yelling, and you'd think everybody there was hard of hearing because, I mean, they're at the top of their lungs just carrying on. And I can just imagine how excited they were because this woman's been gone for over a decade, and here she walks back into town. Is it really Naomi? They asked. And she heard them. She must have. Because she said, "Don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant. She responded, "Instead, call me Mara, for the Almighty has made life very bitter for me." And that's what Mara means, bitter. "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back home empty." She's not only angry, not only depressed, she is blaming God for what happened. "Why call me Naomi when the Lord has caused me to suffer and the Almighty has sent me such tragedy upon me?" They arrived in Bethlehem late in spring at the beginning of the barley harvest, which is going to come into play in a major way in this story. So they were alone. Just one of them. And you think about the word one, or the number one. And I thought about some synonyms and put this thing together. Think about some of the synonyms of being alone. Discarded, maybe. Rejected. Dejected. Forgotten. Cast off. Deserted. Dumped. Forsaken. Kind of reminds me of the great hymn by the gospel group, Three Dog Night. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do, and two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. One is the loneliest number. You think about that. And you can be alone in a crowd. You can be lonely in a crowd, and she was. Her pain had taken over her emotions. But it was harvest time, and even in the pain, and even in the desperation, and even in the depression, they had to put some food on the table. And this harvest only lasted about 8 weeks, and they had to make preparation not just for today and tomorrow, but for the coming months. And so there was a law in Israel that whenever it came time for the harvest, those who were harvesting, the owners and those who served them, were only allowed to go through the field one time, one pass. Whatever you miss stays. You were not allowed to harvest the corners. They were to be left. And that was kind of the welfare program, in a sense, in Israel, or at least part of it. That was left for the poor, for the people that did not own property, for the alien that was in their midst, to go and harvest that so that they would not starve. And so Ruth says to Naomi, "You're too sick to do this. I'll go and harvest." And so Naomi kind of gave her the ropes, told her what she needed to do. And so she went and she found a field. And she started harvesting in that field. And we come to Ruth chapter 2 and verse 3. There's a chance encounter. "So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters," because they were only going to take one pass, so anything they left was fair game. "As it turned out," I love that phrase, "as it turned out," today we might say, "Well, it just so happened." "As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech," a relative of her ex-husband, of her ex-father-in-law, a relative of the family. And what ensued was a series of questions that led up to kind of the climax of the story. First of all, Boaz happens, it just so happens, to show up in the field that day to check on the harvest. And he just so happened to notice this girl out there. And he says, "Who's the young woman?" Or, "Who is the young woman?" Or, "Whose young woman is that?" Today, probably if it was you or I, we'd say, who's the hot chick? But who is she? And the answer comes, well, she's the Moabitess who came back with Naomi. Well, Boaz had heard about Ruth and Naomi because they're relatives. And he'd heard about how Ruth had stayed with Naomi and traveled that 2 weeks with her, how Ruth had been taking care of Naomi, and how Ruth was now going out to harvest to help care for Naomi. He had heard of the good things that she had done. And so it says, he said back to that, Boaz says to his servants and to the foreman and such, you take care of her. I'm taking a little liberty, but not much. Give her the VIP treatment. In fact, whenever you're putting together the sheaves, if you were to pull out a few and let them lay on the ground, that would be a good idea. So that Ruth has more. So Ruth is going out just to get kind of whatever she can get. And she comes back with like 10 2-liter Coke bottles full of barley. And Ruth is looking at the groceries and says, where did you get that? And so some more questions come along. Ruth says, why have I found favor in your sight? I got ahead of myself. I'm a foreigner. And Boaz says, well, I've heard what you've done to your widowed mother-in-law and the sacrifices you made and the risks you've taken. And the response is, I hope I continue to please you, sir. You have comforted me. And so Naomi sees the groceries and asks with a question, what field did you work in today? And Ruth says, well, his name is Boaz. And Naomi says, well, Boaz, he's your kinsman redeemer. Now, you understand the kinsman redeemer was part of the plan that God had given to the people of Israel because he wanted each family's lineage to continue, because it was through the lineage of those in Israel that the Christ would come, and they wanted to be able to trace that back. And so to provide a continuation of the family lineage, if a man died leaving no heirs, which Elimelech had heirs, but his heirs died, and they left no heirs, so there was no heirs for Elimelech's family. A close relative who was willing could marry the widow, have children by her, and her dead husband's family name would continue. Even though he had the children by this widowed woman, the name that would go with the children would be the name of the deceased. And so the family name would continue. The closest relative, however, got first right of refusal, and then it passed to the next and the next until one person, one kinsman redeemer, was willing. The kinsman redeemer got some privileges. He got the land. He had to purchase it, but he had to purchase the land, and that usually meant that it would enrich him. However, whenever he died, that land would go to the heirs that came as a result of that relationship as the kinsman redeemer. But he also had to take on the responsibilities that went with the land. The widowed herself, any other relatives, in this case, Naomi. And if there were any debts, he had to pay the debts. And so, you know, it was a great responsibility, but it was also a privilege. But it was God's plan. Well, Naomi hears about this, and Naomi decides she's going to play Cupid. She said, he's your kinsman redeemer, or at least a kinsman redeemer. And so here's what you need to do. You need to go whenever they are winnowing the barley. And whenever evening comes and it's time to rest, you need to go and find Boaz. And you need to lay at his feet and uncover his feet with the cloak that's there, that's over him. In that time, they had usually three garments, an undergarment, and then an outer garment, and then a kind of a cloak of sorts that they use to cover themselves at night. So kind of a layering thing. And so she did that after Boaz was resting for the night. He had finished eating and drinking, and he went to, had gone to sleep. She went and laid down at his feet, uncovered his feet. And what happens if you uncover somebody's feet in a cool night? I know what happens to me. My feet get cold. Okay? And usually I'm going to wake up. So Boaz woke up, and he looks, and Boaz has this conversation. Who are you? Ruth replies, I'm your servant Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. That's in chapter 3 and verse 9. Now I want you to note that back, I hadn't read this yet, but I'm going to read it to you now. Back in Ruth chapter 2, verse 12, when Boaz first sees her in the field, he says to her, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And here's the neat part, okay? In chapter 2, when he says, may you be blessed and come under the cover of God's wings. The word wings in the Hebrew is the exact same word as the word garment that she just said, cover me with your garment. Cover me with your wings. She basically at that moment is challenging Boaz to become the blessing that he had placed on her and said, God bless you. And you know that happens. Sometimes we pray, Lord, bless so-and-so. And perhaps what we should be saying in that prayer is, Lord, make me a blessing of so-and-so. Well, Boaz takes the hint. And so the problem is for Boaz that he's not first in line. So he finds out who is first in line. He goes to the gate of the city where the men gather, and he calls 10 men together who were well respected. And it says to them, it says that this is he's the second in line kinsman, but the first has to refuse, of course. And then in Ruth chapter 4 and verse 9 says, then Boaz said to the elders and to the crowd around, you are witnesses that today I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. And with the land I have acquired Ruth, the Moabite woman of Mahlon, to be my wife. This way she can have a son to carry on the family name of her dead husband and to inherit the family property here in this hometown. You are all witnesses of that. Now, before all that happened, the text says, it came to pass, or so it happened, or meanwhile, when he showed up, it was just at that time that he showed up that the first kinsman redeemer showed up. It just so happened. It just so happened. And so he tells him the situation and basically sets up the man. He said, hey, you have an opportunity to buy this property. And he said, well, I want it. I want it. He said, but when you do, you're going to have to take Naomi, and you're going to have to take Ruth, and you're going to have to pay the debts, and you're going to have to, and he starts thinking of all the that's going to potentially do and mess up his own situation. He says, no, you can have it. And they had a deal there in Israel where if you wanted to refuse that, you would take one shoe off and hand your shoe to the person who would receive the role of kinsman redeemer. And so he took the shoe off and passed it to Boaz. And so we come to Ruth chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth into his home, and she became his wife. When he slept with her, the Lord enabled her to become pregnant, and she gave birth to a son. Then the women of the town said to Naomi, praise the Lord who has now provided a redeemer for your family. May this child be famous in Israel. Oh, would he? May he restore your youth and care for you in your old age, for he is the son of your daughter-in-law, who loves you and has been better to you than seven sons. And Naomi took the baby and cuddled him to her breast, and she cared for him as if he were her own. So what was God doing? Well, looking back at that story, it just so happened. It just so happened that Elimelech decided to go to Moab, even though he was living in the breadbasket, but God had allowed a famine to occur there, and so Elimelech leaves. And it just so happens when he gets there, his two sons marry Moabite women. And it just so happens that neither of those marriages produce a child. And it just so happens that both Elimelech and the children, the sons all die. She heads back. And it just so happened that one of the daughters-in-law refused to go back, and she decided that she's going to go, and she's going to stay with Naomi, and she's going to take care of Naomi, and she's going to convert to Judaism. She's going to become a believer in God. She has decided that her God is going to be her God. Just so happened when they got there that she went to harvest barley for her and Naomi, and it just so happened she picked the field that Boaz happened to own. It just so happened that that day Boaz showed up and saw her and took note of her, and it just so happened that whenever she went home with all of this barley that Boaz had provided for her because he had kind of taken a liking to her because of what she had done for Naomi, it just so happened that Naomi said, you know, that's a kinsman redeemer, and it just so happened they have a plan, and it just so happened that they get married, have a child, and the lineage continues. It just so happened. And then verse 17. The neighbor women said, now at last Naomi has a son again. And they named him Obed. And it just so happened that Obed became the father of Jesse. And it just so happened that Jesse became the father of David. And it just so happens that Ruth became the great, 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 great grandmother of Jesus, who was the Messiah. And so when Naomi was bitter and wanting to be called Mara and saying, where is God? God had not forgotten her. In fact, God had her dead center in the epicenter of his plan. It just so happened. Well, come back to where we began. And I ask you again, what is God doing in your life? Well, that's your story. But in my story, it just so happened that we were in Tupelo, Mississippi. I did not know that I had liver disease, not in the sense that it ultimately failed. I didn't know anybody on the East Coast, quite honestly. On Memorial Day 2008, I'm sitting there resting after eating. I get a call from a guy with an accent from the Bronx. Name's Mike Spicone. He happens to be an elder at the church in Wilmington, Delaware. And he said, I have your resume. And I thought, you got my resume? I didn't send you my resume. I didn't say that, but I said, how did you get my resume? I said, Charles Seibert from ACU sent it to me. We're looking for a preacher, and I called him, and he said, you need to check out this guy. I said, okay. And, you know, Gail and I were kind of thinking we ready to move and needed to move and all of that. And I said, well, we went to Delaware one time and went to the beach, and that's about all I knew about Delaware. But I said, hey, it's a free plane ride. We'll get to eat some food, meet some people. Why not? Yeah. So we went to Delaware. We were the second of three finalists. It just so happened it went really well. And they canceled the last person to come, and they hired me pretty much the next week. We moved to Delaware. All my kids were either in Texas or Tennessee, and we moved anywhere from 1,000 to 1,600 miles away from my kids and grandkids. Yep, that's what we did. Gail loved it. Not so much. Well, it just so happened that my liver disease got worse, and I was referred to this hospital and ultimately in Philadelphia, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And it just so happened that 8 years later, my liver failed. I nearly died. They got me back from the brink, ready to go home again to wait for a liver. And just the night before I was to go home, the next morning, I get a call from a transplant coordinator and saying, "We have a liver for you if you want it." And my response was, "Duh." And so, that evening, the 29th of June of 18, I received the liver of a deceased 46-year-old black woman. I'm in touch with my African-American roots. She had a cardiac arrest and died, and her family and her had made plans to be donors. And so I'm alive because she died. But my liver got so bad it killed my kidneys. And they were only working about 10%. They were hoping they would regenerate because they had a new liver to play with that was playing fair. But it didn't happen. And so I was listed on February the 1st of this year for a kidney transplant. The average wait in this region is 5 to 6 years. And over half die before they get a kidney. I was listed on February 1st. I got a call. It just so happens on February the 2nd. I was third in line. It just so happens that the two in front of me were not a good match. It just so happens that the blood that I gave them to check, not only blood type, but they knew that, but blood antibodies, and you have to have very few antibodies that will fight with their antibodies or it will reject. I had zero. Zero antibodies that would fight with the donors. It just so happens. It just so happens. Folks, it just so happens is another way of saying God has shown up in a big way. And so, I ask you, are you aware of the plan that God has for you? God has a plan. And you need to figure out what that plan is and join Him. I love what the lead singer in I had it in my brain and it just left me. It'll come to me at lunch. But anyway, he said in our group we used to pray before we launched a new album and that this would be a very effective and carry the message and all that kind of thing. Bono, thank you God. Finally, Bono used to say that. He said, "Now then, what we do is we try to figure out where God's working and join Him there. We need to look where God's working and make sure our life is joining Him there." So what's God doing in your life? Has God been at work in your life even during the really, really dark times, preparing you? I can tell you, over 40 years ago, I was praying that I would one day have the faith that my mother had. That I would have the personal relationship with Jesus that my mother had. And it seemed so elusive. But I found that in this journey. And my faith is different and more personal now than it has ever been. And I'm here to sing the praises of God and His Son, Jesus Christ, because it just so happened that He chose to work in me. And He's working in you. And if you feel a need for us to help you in that work, if we can serve you in any way, we sing a song here, I understand, an invitation or encouragement song. And so, if we can pray for you, if we can serve you in any way, let us know in some way. You can come to the front, talk to us afterwards, do whatever you're comfortable with, but in some way, let us be a part of your life as a part of this family. Let's stand and sing.